Just write that on a bit of paper. You do not need anything else.
Yeah.
Because
that's it.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
There is a period where I'm like, can I do this? For me personally, it's a blend of self-doubt, fear, and fun. I was not exceptional at school, but the one thing I could do was draw. I have no idea. I say this without wanting to sound preachy. I think you've got to be prepared to hustle a little bit or a lot. I don't know if there's a right answer to that without sounding like a twat. It's your opportunity to be yourself, but not be. I say this to lots of graduates I speak to. Don't try and be something you're not. Don't try and be what you think they want you to be. It tricks you.
Now, Steve was something else. Like, that was fun, wasn't it?
It was really fun. Yeah, he had some great stories.
So many great stories. Yeah. So many, we went in many tangents, yes, didn't we?
For sure.
What do you think's the biggest takeaway that you've had?
I really liked the respondent react.
Nice.
Message that he had. And yeah, he was just a very interesting guy. He was really good.
Definitely. Well, I think our audience needs to go and find out what respond, not react means. So let's hand you into this episode now.
Hi, I'm Steve, and I'm taking you behind the future.
Welcome to Behind the Future. I am really excited to be joined by the wonderful Nina today. Nina, tell us a bit about yourself.
Hello, I'm Nina. I'm a year 13 student studying media, business, and psychology A-levels, and hopefully studying marketing at university next year.
Love that. You're in a very good place to learn a bit more about
for
it
sure.
Then. Fantastic. And our guest today is the wonderful Steve. Steve, tell us a bit more about yourself.
Hi, I'm to this camera.
Yeah, to that camera.
We'll have to cut that bit. I'm Steve Price, creative director, father, husband, son, brother, dog walker. Really, I got grade 9 at dishwashing, like emptying and stacking. So
amazing.
You can't put that on LinkedIn though, apparently.
No, and so, you do it on time or do you wait for it to build up sitting on top of the dishwasher?
No, I'm very efficient with it.
Love it. Yeah. Oh, you can move in then.
But I do cheat. I put it on a 70 degree wash sometimes.
Oh, really? Wow.
It's not good for the environment, but you know what? You've got to spoil yourself sometimes.
Yeah, and everything is squeaky clean at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Good.
So there you go.
So we've learned a lot. So you're a creative director. I'm going to hand over to Nina. Yeah. Where do we want to start?
So what is your job role? What do you do usually?
I have no idea. It's, for me personally, it's a blend of self-doubt, fear, and fun.
Nice.
Which aren't necessarily bad things. They sound like bad things, but I learned a long time ago that I was asked once on a panel, like I was on a panel with like four other people and they were like, oh, what motivates you? And I was last and they all took the answers I would have given. So I brutally just went shitting myself. That's generally, I get a brief from anyone and there is a period where I'm like, can I do this? But creative direction, I don't know. It's a really fun job that I've loved ever since I discovered what art and design was. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, at the moment, it's kind of, it's changing and evolving really quickly. And I think for me, I've never wanted to pigeonhole myself as a, well, I only do print or I do digital and nothing else. I think creativity and particularly design can manifest itself in a myriad of ways. And even if you don't know how to do something, there's a lot of people else that can help you. So I think the one thing that I think a lot of people shouldn't do is limit themselves.
Love that.
Yeah, definitely.
Where's your happiest place from a creative point of view? Because I guess one of the things I always...
Shitting myself. Literally and figuratively.
Well, I think like if I put myself back in Nina's shoes, I had no idea that there was a job that was creative director that potentially could be more about the ideas than the execution. But actually, where do you sit? Because do you still do execution?
Yeah, I mean, look, job titles are hilarious, you know, and they seem to be getting more and more convoluted and lofty. Everybody on LinkedIn's a founder.
Yeah.
Everyone's an entrepreneur. If entrepreneur means doing something for yourself or for the first time, then great, cool, crack on. But I think a lot of pressures, not pressure, but just creative director. I've never really considered myself as a director, but I am creative. And I think the job itself typically is about working with people and finding the best way to work with them, whether that's your team, whether it's clients, whether it's your peers, or trying to get people to work with you. You know, you've got to be kind of like a salesperson. You've got to be good at selling ideas. You have to try and be engaging. But do I still get my hands dirty? Yeah, absolutely. Because my education into design was very much about doing it yourself. Like, I'm old enough now to remember when I was doing my degree, we had like Apple Mac computers, as they were called back then, but we were banned from using them for the first 2 years. So we had to hand render all of our own typography. And we had projects where we had to do eight double page spreads of a paperback novel. We had to pick one and then hand render all of the type. So when you've set type at 8.4 point size and, you know, 11 point leading, you learn to respect the craft and then you can go and fuck it up and break it. But I think there's a friend of mine who is now a Michelin star chef in Bergen in Norway, where I used to live. And he always said to me, because he was a punk and he still is a bit of a punk. Love you, Chris. But he always said, you know, it's in order to be a rebel, it's important you understand the rules and learn them. Then you have the license to break them. Yeah. So even if I'm working on a project where I'm doing more of the running of the project and the organizing and looking after the client or whatever it might be, I will find stuff to do outside of work that keeps me interested. I think that's kind of important to me.
Love that. Yeah. Oh, there's so many things to unpick in there, isn't there? I'll let you go.
So you mentioned that you went to university.
I did.
What did you
study?
They
let me in.
They let you in. What did you study and how has it helped you in your career so far?
I did a BA at Nottingham Trent in graphic design.
Nice.
Fun fact, I actually got accepted to St. Martin's to do a BA. And when I went home, I grew up in Kent. You're from Kent, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know why I pointed at you. And I went home and I was like, I got a place at St. Martin's. And my mom and dad, who were lovely and have always been very supportive, and they were like, well, we only live 40 minutes on the train, so you can go in from here. And I was like, So I went in the next day to Maidstone Art College, where I did my foundation. And rang Nottingham Trent, which is my second choice, which admittedly I chose because the course was good, but also I was misled with the there's 9 women to every man, which I later found out applies to retirees and OAPs, which is that your bag, right?
Probably not as an 18-year-old.
But yeah, I did my BA at Nottingham Trent, which was great. I think 2 years after that, I did a master's at St. Martin's, which I think if you were a student from abroad was terrible.
Yeah.
Because there was absolutely nothing then. I'm sure it's got a lot better.
Yeah.
But back then you were paying 16 grand a year to be a student from abroad. And we didn't even have a room, never mind desks and chairs. We had a part-time tutor that ran the course. So yeah, it was good. But I genuinely think these days, I have a 19-year-old son who I'm trying to encourage not to go to uni, because I think there are different and better ways in. And I have worked with people that didn't go to uni who are exceptional at what they do, because who knew creativity is a natural talent?
Yeah.
And going to university, I don't think always prepares you. And I have to be really delicate. I'm not going to lambast the whole of the education system, but I think there are plenty of schools that don't do a good enough job, both at A-level and senior school and colleges and universities that actually don't give you the tools you need to exist as a human being, and particularly in the creative industry. You know, they'll teach you about trigonometry and Pythagoras and stuff like that. I can tell you I've never used those in my career. I can barely just about add VAT onto my invoices. And I've even got that wrong sometimes. So, you know, I think there are much more practical uses that could be used to prepare people.
How did you know design was your path?
So I have a very supportive family. So I'll get that out there. I have a very supportive, loving wife who tolerates me. But I have to always give credit to my art teacher. So Mrs. Everest, I have tried to find her. I hope she's still alive, but I did a whole campaign trying to find her once, because when she was, when I was 15, as I said earlier, I think off camera, I probably was acting a fool because I was not exceptional at school, but the one thing I could do was draw. And when I was 15, she literally dragged me into a storeroom, and I'm going to swear now. So she was like, if you don't stop fucking around, you could be really good at this. And that was the first time I'd ever had a teacher swear, but not at me because I was being naughty, but because she saw something. And I had no idea at the age of 15, but what she said to me subsequently after that, I've never forgotten, and I've lived by. And she said, have you got a sketchbook? And I was like, what do you mean? She said, go and buy a sketchbook and fill it. And then you go and buy another one and another one. I have got every sketchbook from that day in my cupboard at home. And there's a lot of them. That's so cool. It's a lot of shit as well. But and so I kind of started on that journey thanks to her.
Yeah.
I don't know if she hadn't said anything, I genuinely don't know if I would have found my career. And then I still kind of, I finished A-levels. I got into Maidstone Art College to do a foundation, which I still think people should do because I think it's a great year spent, you know, just trying stuff. And then there was a guy, I forget his name. His name was Andy, but I can't remember his surname. Lovely guy. And he saw the work I was doing and was like, you've got to go and do graphic design. And I was like, what's that? Because I think, you know, we've talked about this before. There's a lot of people, you can ask anyone that question, and you clearly do. Most people don't know about the creative industries until way too late. So I think the work you guys are doing is fantastic because, you know, I think more people like yourself get exposed to, you know, what the possibilities are, because teachers have a hard enough job, you know, trying to manage their job for what they get paid for and the hassle that they get, without having to be expected to know about all of the things that are possible.
Yeah.
I was just saying earlier, my careers teacher when I was 15, around the same time, it was a pivotal year for me. He was also my maths teacher and the teacher who took everyone skiing for a year. So he clearly just had one objective in life. He laughed when I said I really thought the idea of architecture was fun. And he said I should do something in the military. So,
wow.
You know, so, but again, like, I don't blame him. Like, what would he know about architecture?
Yeah,
wouldn't expect him to. But I think it's a vast and a rapidly expanding industry that has so much potential, and it's shifting all the time. Like, there's never been a better time to just start making stuff and experimenting.
Yeah, it is exciting, isn't it? And it's so accessible as well from a digital perspective. Yeah. But I think you're right, because we're surrounded by things that creators have made, but you don't look at it and go, oh, someone was behind that.
Yeah.
And I could be the person that was, I could come up with that advertising board, that whatever it is.
It's really weird.
Yeah, you just take it for granted. Like, people will be looking on the internet all the time. They'll be using apps on their phone. Yeah. No one ever goes, oh, I wonder who made this and could I be part of making this?
Yeah, there's so many careers that you don't know exist until you meet someone that has it.
Well, exactly. And you know, but people's perception of films, people inherently understand that there'll be a director, there'll be a writer, there'll be a casting director, there'll be producers, because it's in the credits.
Yeah.
The problem is people see, so from when I was 15, we didn't have the internet. Like, you were reliant on your Game Boy for fun and watching TV and films.
But I guess also you probably didn't think I could work creating the games for the Game Boy.
Like,
you just
not.
That's just something that you've bought and that you get to play with, not, I could work here.
Yeah.
Or the graphics or the characters or anything.
Yeah, it's madness, isn't it?
But now you can, so off you go.
Yeah.
So you work in the digital industry, and how has AI affected your job? And because it's very creative, so how has AI affected it?
For me personally, I decided about a year ago, I think I've been using it, you know, as soon as it was kind of released into the wild. I dabbled in it and I was like, well, that's weird. It's kind of freaky. And then, you know, you had platforms like Adobe releasing Firefly and you go, oh my God, that is actually saving me time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I can remove the background. That's my arthritic fingers will thank me.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, and that's how I suppose revolutions in technology or any revolution kind of happen. It kind of drip feeds. It feels like it's a big thing that's just happened, but it slowly drip feeds into your life. I think that there are plenty of negative examples LinkedIn job boards, companies, making lots of redundancies because they're suddenly turning into an AI transformation business. All that means is they are dialing up the word salad that nobody understands and leaving people with actual talent to kind of go and fend for themselves, or worse, ghosting them into oblivion. But I don't think that's the fault of AI. I think it's a myriad of things. I think as a creative person, you have many things that AI will never have. One of them is curiosity, and the other is hunger. And I think me personally, I am relentlessly curious, as I think most people, human beings are in general, but it can be a curse being constantly curious because you just see things or you think about things, or I have my Moleskine notebook. Other notebooks are available, but I have one next to my bed because I often will wake up in the middle of the night and I'll have dreamt about something, or, you know, and AI can't replace that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. AI can't, I mean, hands up, when was the last time AI came to you with a scamp or a drawing or an idea or a line or an idea for a book and went, you know what you should do? You should do that. We should do this.
Yeah.
Nobody. Because it's passive and it's very clever. You know, it's helped me in many ways, you know, in terms of research or testing things or, you know, writing stuff and then like testing whether it works or not or looking at different structures. So it can be really good. It can be a really positive influence. Given that I have just started a new partnership called Human Services, which is all about we're not anti-AI or anti-social. Mm-hmm. We are about kind of let's return back a little bit to enjoy what makes us unique from the machine.
I love that. So this is very much in the present AI. If we roll back, you've done your degree. What's your first job look like in the creative world?
Oh, I was talking to someone yesterday about this. A brilliant graduate called Lucy Lee, who I've been, I guess, working with. I cannot say I'm mentoring, but she just graduated from, I think, Sheffield University and has just started a job. And she's like, oh, you know, I'm kind of like the lackey, so I'm a bit busy, but, you know, I'll get back to you. And I was like, my first job was with a company called 1210, which was a design agency in Nottingham. And it was great. I think I spent about 6 months there. I was living kind of rent-free with a friend, but I had to live in their attic because their landlord didn't know about me. Okay. There was no heating up there, so I had to buy an electric heater, which was probably a fire hazard.
Was it actually boarded out as an attic?
Oh, yeah, okay. But that was literally all there was up there.
So you were just like between the floorboards hoping for the best.
I had a sleeping bag.
Wow.
I woke up one night with a rat in it.
Oh my gosh.
Not on it, sorry, on it. I spent a lot of time doing, because they work mainly with all the clubs in Nottingham, so I was doing like club flyers, which is fun.
Yeah.
They were also, I think, part of the first Channel 4 kind of fly on the wall documentary, which I appeared in, but I was literally sweeping the floor most of the time. that was my first job.
Wow, amazing. And how did it grow from there? Like, what does, if someone listening today is thinking about being a creative, you start there. How do you get to being a creative director?
Well, I think it's only started there because I think, you know, I say this without wanting to sound preachy. I think you've got to be prepared to hustle a little bit or a lot. That doesn't mean you need to be extrovert or super confident or something that you're not. But I think you need to be prepared to just hustle and hassle people, you know. I didn't get that job because they found me.
Yeah.
Actually, they did at my degree show, but I still had to follow up. I had to phone them. I had to go and, you know, see them and speak to them. And that's nothing new, but it's whether you do that on a video call now or whether you do it in person. I think that it's important to kind of prepare yourself, but you could start doing that. So when you're starting uni next year,
yeah,
just hustle from day one. And also a lot of the people that you'll be at university with, you may be fortunate in that some of them will become lifelong friends. Mm-hmm. They will also go on to work in other industries and hopefully one day become the very sharp end and CEOs. they're your network. And it starts then,
yeah.
You know, maybe, I don't know how you get on with your friends at school, but I can count on one hand the amount of people I stayed in touch with from school. But as you get older and you go to university, I still know a lot of people that I went to university with who are doing really amazing things. And I don't necessarily work with them, but, you know, I think you're kind of, I think, forced to think about getting work in a certain way. And I think that, you know, you're heading into an industry that's creative. That doesn't mean you need to be silly and overly creative or plaster Paris your foot to get a foot in the door. I've heard of that happening.
Wow.
But, you know, there are novel ways of doing stuff. Uh-huh. And I can tell you for now, one way that you can stand out, or anyone listening, the smartphone you have in your pocket also telephones people.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I don't get this many these days. It's people calling me. I'll get emails. I'll get DMs on LinkedIn and people messaging me. Mm-hmm. Ring people.
Okay.
It will scare the shit out of them.
Yeah.
And then keep ringing them until you get a meeting with them. And wherever possible, go and meet them in real life, because my preference is that, because you learn so much more from meeting people in real life and engaging with them. And the only other thing I would say as well is, by the time you've got to sit in front of someone, they've probably made some kind of judgment of like, yeah, okay, I like the cut of their jib, or I've seen some of their work, I like what they do. If they're meeting you, it's because they want to see and hear you. And I think everything you do outside of work, everything you do outside of what you get paid to do, is actually what makes you more interesting. So whether you're into knitting or cold water swimming, or you like building your own sauna in a caravan, cool, talk about it. Equally, I think when you're showing your work, I personally am always more interested in how you got to an idea rather than the output. Mm. Because I think it tells a lot about how you think, how you see the world. If you just go, oh yeah, I did this project for a charity because I had to pick one.
Yeah.
You go, why don't you pick something you care about? Because I think passion is underrated. I think if you can speak about something with genuine conviction, it's because you care about it. And if you care about it, it doesn't guarantee that you'll get a job. But it sure as shit is better than sitting there going, well, I just like design, or I like social medias.
Yeah. You
know, yeah, that's not
the
I'm not looking for that. I'm always looking for people that are hungry, and you can see it.
Yeah.
You can feel it. You can spot it. And that's why I'm saying, wherever you can, meet people in person, because it's your opportunity to be yourself. Mm-hmm. But not be, I say this to lots of graduates I speak to, don't try and be something you're not. Don't try and be what you think they want you to be, because an interview, I know we've jumped ahead, but an interview is a two-way thing, right? Yeah. So 100%. As much as you feel like the spotlight's on you, literally, it isn't. It's also on them. Yeah. How they treat you, how they reply to you, how that build up to you meeting them, where they meet you, how they speak to you. Like, if there are any things in your thing where you go, well, that's a bit shitty, or, well, that's really rude.
Yeah.
Fuck them off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I can guarantee you, those tiny little things you think, oh, well, but it's still a job and, oh, they've offered me it. You will probably be miserable working there.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of dickheads in this industry. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of them.
Yeah. No, he's a good
interesting.
One.
Interesting. Yeah.
Just a quick note from me. We'd love you to hit the subscribe button. This helps us more than you might realize when it comes to growing this podcast, ensuring we can bring you the best guests possible. Thank you. Back to the episode.
You mentioned Norway earlier. How did you end up living in Norway?
Yeah.
what was that part of the story?
So when my son was 3 and a half, his mum and I didn't really want him to go to school at 4 in the UK, and his mum's half Norwegian. We were originally going to move to Malaysia because she's half Malaysian, half Norwegian. And I went out there for 6 months to KL, loved it. And then the financial crash happened.
Right.
So that job that I was out there doing was no longer available, but Norway was always a backup. So we moved to Norway, and he got to go to kindergarten until he was 6 years old. It was in Bergen, so it's a relatively small city. I think it's about 50 or 60,000 population, but it's beautiful. And I didn't really appreciate it as much when I was living there, but I really miss it, actually. You know, there's it's kind of surrounded by seven mountains. Well, not that big, but seven mountains. You're right by the ocean.
Wow.
It just feels clean.
Yeah.
And he went to his kindergarten up the funicular lift every morning onto the mountain.
Wow.
It's just insane.
That's so
right?
fun.
And yeah, it was great. I look back on it with as a really cherished time. And I made lots of friends there. In order to try and get my name out there, because I was kind of starting from afresh, I didn't really know anyone there. So I was teaching at the Arts Academy there for about 2 years. I was a associate professor. That's a lofty title for me.
It's nice. I like it. Sounds good.
Well, I was qualified as one. The weird thing is that they discounted me as a full professor because apparently I lacked international experience, even though I'd worked in more countries than any of the other professors. America and Malaysia isn't international enough, apparently. But what it actually was, you got paid half the amount that a professor does. So.
Right, yeah.
But it was a great place. But I set up a Petra Kucha night because if you live in a city where there wasn't a Petra Kucha night, have you ever heard of Petra Kucha?
No, I'm looking at you, Gary. Okay. What's that? Petra Kucha? I didn't even know if I said that right.
So there's Mark Dytham and Astrid Klein. I think no, I don't know if they're still married, but they're amazing architects. That British architect, Swedish architect. They lived in Tokyo. They wanted to set up a night where they could get people to come to their bar in a Roppongi district called Super Deluxe. So they set up this thing called Petra Kucha, which in Japanese, I'm mispronouncing it, I apologize, means like chitter-chatter, like small talk.
Okay.
Yeah. So a Petra Kucha night is a series of speakers, but you only get 20 slides and you only get 20 seconds per slide.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
So any speaker, even if they're shit, they get 6 minutes and 40 seconds to bore the audience or entertain them.
Yeah.
And if you live in a city where there isn't a Petra Kucha night, you can apply for a license and it's free. And then you're then duty bound to put on a minimum of 4 a year.
Wow.
So I was approached by a theatre in Bergen that I got to know really well, an amazing theatre just outside of the city. And we set up a Petra Kucha night.
Wow.
I think the first one we had about 150 ticket sales, but I didn't want to do just like speakers. So we put on... Bergen and Norway in general, like lots of Scandinavian countries, has an incredible music scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, black metal came from Bergen. Yeah. Like it's so rich in talent. And so I wanted to make a night that was like live music, speakers. In the end, I think on our 12th one, just before I moved back to the UK, we had like 600 people.
Wow,
and we had four bands. I had a food truck, well, not me personally, but we organized a food truck from a brilliant restaurant in town called Sot or Salt, which is sugar and salt. So they turned up with amazing food. My son's aunt, who's got an amazing cafe in Bergen called Helaisen, she came with her ice cream bike. So there's a cinnamon bun in Norway called a Schillingsboller.
Delicious. I've had one.
Amazing. But they made the first Schillingsboller ice cream. So you can have this kind of like cinnamon bun flavored ice cream. So we had like the whole night. And it was a great, but I did it really to get to know people and get my name out there. And I still work with some of those people now. It's, you know, kind of really, it was a really lovely way to kind of make a bit of an entrance. But I did the first one we ever did, we tried to theme each one. And the first Petra Kucha night was all about your first. So what first did you do?
Mm-hmm.
And I used to host the night. So it was my opportunity to get about as close to stand-up comedy. And I don't think I'm funny, but I was like, I'm going to go to town on this. So I like wore a black suit, black tie. And because it was in a theater, everything's there. They had this amazing PA system. The producer was amazing. I once asked her if we could get a tree for a Halloween night. And she arrived with a silver birch tree on top of her car that she cut down from her garden.
Like, oh, my word.
I've got pictures.
Oh, my gosh.
It was absolutely amazing. Camilla Svingen, I love her. She's she's still a dear friend and a client as well. But on the first night, I thought my opening intro, this was the first opening night, like, what can I talk about? And I thought it'd be a great idea to talk about the first time I lost... when I lost my virginity, so the first time I had sex, and replayed it, not the actual sex bit, but I replayed the build-up to what happened because I thought it was really funny, to what is quite a conservative country.
Yeah.
But thankfully, we didn't start the show until like 10 o'clock in the evening because we knew if we could get them in and get them drunk, we're way more accepted.
Yeah, so. And how did it go? It was all right?
I think there was a few mixed responses to my. I was at one point on the floor. I wasn't acting out the sex bit, because the joke was there wasn't actually any sex.
Okay.
The joke was what happened to all the condoms I took with me, which I couldn't find. So that was, I acted it out, and I'm not sure it would make it into my live show if I did it again. But it was fun.
What a story. And
I can't remember what the question was.
I have no idea either.
Sorry.
I don't know how we got there, but it was great. Oh,
Norway.
Just
Norway.
Yeah.
Norway.
How long were you in Norway for?
In total, about 8 or 9 years, I think.
Wow.
The sad part is I split up with his mom when about 6 months after we moved. So then we had to kind of make that work. And I was eventually I moved back to London. I was traveling I was taking 6 flights a month to kind of see him, and that didn't work out. So I moved back. And that's when I started up the Petra Kooch thing. I moved back in 2013, I think.
Wow.
And then Brexit. I don't know if you heard about this.
Yeah.
This thing called Brexit.
Yeah.
That happened, and my already extortionately expensive rent on the lovely apartment I had, almost tripled.
Wow.
So very quickly I had to kind of pack up and move back, and it was lovely. I fully recommend. It's not always easy, but I honestly think the best thing, certainly as a creative person, but I think generally, if you can live abroad, if you can work in another country, obviously Norway, they all speak really good English. Mm-hmm. I did try, but the problem is the minute you open your mouth and they hear the English tone, so I used to get into these really crazy situations where I would order something in Norwegian badly. Mm-hmm. They would reply in English, and I would stick with trying to speak Norwegian badly. And they'd just be like, yeah, that's fine. What else would you like? What can I get in your, do you want cheese in your sandwich? You go, yeah, tuck. And, or if I didn't do that, for some reason, and I can't explain why, in order to save embarrassing the great British English language, I would pretend to be American, because Americans, you know, people think differently about Americans. They accept that they're a bit
more. I won't mention the fact I'm from New York.
Yeah, but that's a good part, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, sorry, you mean Trumpland?
Yeah. No. Yeah.
I think living abroad, or at least working abroad as often as possible, mm-hmm. I think is a really great way to open your eyes and your ears. Yeah. And I think whether you get to live there or work there, I see a lot of people doing lots of research using AI and, you know, all of the desktop tools that we can use. Part of what we're doing at Human Services is actually, let's get some boots on the ground, right?
Yeah.
So let's go to those places and speak to actual human beings, right?
Yeah.
If you're doing it, if you're a client, and I say this as a warning to everyone in the industry, because they should listen to me, but I think clients are getting wary to it. Mm-hmm. I think if I was a client and your team are just consistently serving up stuff, and it might be great stuff, might not be, it's not that it's not accurate, but if it's only learned from you sitting at home because you can't be asked to go into an office, or you don't want to, or it's not possible, or you don't like flight, whatever the reasons, yeah. I get it. But you have to go and live and breathe culture. It cannot just mm-hmm. be absorbed on social and on your phone and on a desktop.
Yeah.
It's just not the same.
And how do you find creativity transcending different regions and cultures? And because it feels like obviously you've lived in lots of different places. Was that a bit of a journey to go, how do I apply what I learned at home in England to somewhere different?
I don't think so. I mean, when I worked in Malaysia, you know, it was almost like, because I was from the UK and I'd, you know, studied at St. Martin's, and though, you know, I got a first class honours.
Well done. He knows his stuff.
Yes. I think anyone that gets a first, and I do this to anyone I meet, I do it all the time, I go all in on congratulating them, because I know no one gives a shit. But if you get good grades in your A levels, which I'm mm-hmm. sure you will, and you go on to do great things, I think it's worth acknowledging that.
Yeah, right?
Not
it's
for
impressive.
Me, but so I think people had a perception until they met me that, oh, he must know his shit. And then they meet me and I go, weirdo.
Definitely not true.
The one thing I learned in the one thing I love about working with Americans, actually, mm-hmm. mostly, is they're just more direct.
Yeah.
They get shit done, right? Yeah. I've not always, but generally speaking, like there's no fannying around. Sorry, that's probably the main. How American are you?
I've mostly been here British. For 10 years, okay. So yeah.
Yeah. But in Norway, I remember I was working with an agency and we had this meeting and it was, I forget the project now, but I had just, you know, when it was my turn, I just said some stuff and just some ideas I was literally throwing around and they were like, okay, cool. And I remember I went back to my desk and I was working and I remember it was winter. So it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I looked up and I was the only one there because everyone leaves at like 3 o'clock. And I'm like, oh, this is the life balance thing. Yeah. Right, got it. The work, life work balance. And I came in the next day and they'd already implemented some of the things I'd said. And oh, I was wow. like, wait, what? what do you mean? They're like, oh, we liked it. So it was a good idea. And I was like, oh shit, I really need to be careful what I say. Because yeah. You get so used to almost having to fight to be heard, especially in some agencies in London. That's if you get asked. You know, that you can kind of just go, well, I've got this idea. And they go, yeah, yeah, shut up. Not so much now, always. But, yeah. You know, I was very conscious of, I learned to be quite conscious of that. I think doing the Petra Kucha thing was actually quite an interesting way of testing. Will they get offended if I try to perform a sexual act with the rug? No. But I think it's how you deliver it. And I think creativity, it's quite universal.
Yeah.
Again, I think it's about expressing your undying passion and, in my case, mildly obsessive compulsive hobby. That, you know, a friend of mine recently, she's from Mumbai, and we were talking about her experience before she met her husband of dating in Mumbai. And she had a very clear set of list of questions that she'd mentally ask. And the first one was, what's your hobby? And if they didn't have an answer, she would find an excuse to have to leave the date early. And so I was like, oh, right, try the questions on me. And she went, okay, what's your hobby? And I was like, oh. And so I started talking about all the stuff I do, but it was mostly mm-hmm. evolved around stuff that I love doing, which is to do with what I do get paid for.
Yeah.
You know, so I write a lot. I still draw. I'm always sketching ideas out. I'm annoying the shit out of my wife by noticing type errors on a menu, or, you know, I'm thinking about stuff. I'm taking pictures. I'm trying to make little films. I've got a whole series of human moments that I'm writing at the moment in the structure of a sonnet, but they're not poetry. They're just I'm limiting myself to 14 lines to try and tell a story. Can you tell a story in 14 lines? Turns out you can. Who knew? But I think it's about just living and breathing it. Cool. And I don't expect everyone else to, but, you know, mm-hmm. I do.
So with all of the places that you've lived and all the jobs you've done, what has been the toughest challenge to overcome and what lesson has it taught you?
That is a very hard question. I don't know if there's a right answer to that without sounding like a twat. Like, because I could say not appreciating where you are when you have it, you know. Yeah. I am my own worst enemy constantly. I have, you know, huge battles with my self-doubt and what's that thing called? Imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. That fear I mentioned earlier is, you know, it's a good and a bad thing. It's led me to some pretty awful places sometimes, but it's because I think there's a lot of people that are currently feeling kind of exhausted by it all. I know I have gone through phases of that. And what I've come to realize is it's not that you're not hungry. I always talk about being hungry. I'm not hungry. Just I was a chef many years ago before I, you know, from the age of 13 all the way through university. And so a lot of the stuff I think about in food or cooking terms, mm-hmm. but it's not that you're not hungry for what you do. I think you just lost your appetite. And that can come from a myriad of situations, whether it's toxic people at work, and there's a lot of them. It could just be that you're not in quite the right role. I think there's a lot of ways into the creative industry. You know, when I was doing shout out to Help Out and trying to help a lot of graduates get their work seen in lockdown season one, you know, I was saying to them, like, look, if there aren't a lot of jobs going at the moment, maybe go and look at studio management, like, or project manager. There are lots of ways into the industry that might just be springboards to get the jobs that you want, which isn't ideal, but it is tough. So I think that it's if you ever find yourself exhausted, I think it's important to rediscover your appetite. And I think that's not about trying to find necessarily a better job or move jobs. It's about finding, rediscovering the things that you love doing and doing more of that outside of the time you get paid to do the work.
Yeah.
You know, that could be exercise. It could be fishing. It could be skydiving. Or it could just be going for a walk for 30 minutes in the morning. You know, and I think that's helped me.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to walk for nearly an hour because I have two dogs. And apparently I'm the only one that can walk them. but that's not a dig to you, Em. Sorry. That kind of is. She won't be watching this.
She will watch it. She better watch it.
But I think it's creativity can be, for me personally, it can be a curse and it can be a blessing. Mm-hmm. And that sounds really like dramatic. But, you know, people go through things. You know, human beings go through stuff. I can't remember what the question was, but I think it's about trying to appreciate what you have and when you have it, and also appreciate that, you know, some people, even toxic people, you know, they've got shit that they're going through. So either avoid them or try and adapt. And also the last thing on that is respond, don't react.
Interesting.
That's a nice, that's nice. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, because I went through a phase, and maybe just me, but... whatever it is, whether it was an annoying client or a challenge I didn't like, or my ex, you know, you write that ranty email and you just send. And then I went through a phase of going, I'll just write the ranty email and I'll send it to my friend.
Yeah.
Or I'll write it, save it as a draft, delete it, and then think about it. And I think it's taught me a lot about in any situation, whatever it is, just... take a beat, take a step back, go for a walk for an hour. Time is precious, but you can use it to your advantage. And I think I have to do that. So when I've talked about, you know, fear and shitting myself, I often will spend days thinking about stuff, even if I know that I've only got a finite amount of time to get something done. That time I spend thinking about it and letting it digest and mull in my head helps me get to the answer. So I think, yeah, responding rather than reacting is something I have to remind myself of.
For all the latest marketing and brand news, follow The Drum Mag on Instagram.
Love that. And you can also use AI for that now. Do you know, I had
I
was annoyed about something and I wrote out what I wanted to say and then went to ChatGPT and said, I cannot say this to the person I need to say it to. How do I change this?
Yeah.
And it helped me reframe it. And I was like, feels good. And actually ChatGPT's got quite empathetic, hasn't it? It was like, I'm really sorry you've had this experience.
Yeah, but I've had to retrain my ChatGPT is called Chloe, and I have to constantly remind her, I don't want you to be nice to me just because I don't want you to see the positivity in everything I send you. I need you. So we've actually created another ChatGPT called Sophie that is like, she's based on Socrates.
Okay, nice.
So she's brutal. But you kind of need that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can just literally live in your own bubble going, oh, yeah, like, I'm amazing. Chloe loves it. Oh, my God. And then you post it and you go, oh, fuck. It's like you're doing something drunk. Like, stop doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's it tricks you, so be careful.
It's good to have both sides. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. You need the yin and the yang. Otherwise, you can't have someone going, oh, my God, that's so clever. Sorry, I don't know what I'm doing in American accent. You're amazing. I think that's a great idea. Let me just help you reframe that. Would you like me to help you reframe that? And you go, oh, yeah. Yeah. And then you just go copy and paste. And you're, well, that's my life easier. No.
I love that.
Test it and really kick it.
Yeah.
Not literally.
Well, you can kind of literally. I had a good question then and it's gone with all the laughter. Where's it gone?
Sorry.
Have you?
No.
No, okay, so I better have a good question. Where was I going to go? I was going to take you to...
Chris will have to edit this.
No, we'll keep this bit fun there. This is fun. No, my brain's caught back up. Here we go. So, client briefs.
Yes.
They're not always brilliant, but... that's what you get paid for sometimes. Well, all the time is brief comes in, go be creative, mm-hmm. get on, make it happen, come up with a creative idea.
Yeah.
How do you live with that constantly? How do you make sure the creative juices keep flowing, if we want to call it that?
I think if it's possible, and it's not always possible, I've been in plenty of situations where the brief is what the brief is and that's what you got, right? But in an ideal world, a brief to me is more of an invitation. Here's what we think we need. Here's what we think we'd like. Ultimately, we like to write briefs with the client. It's not that we get it and go, right, that shit, because that would be reacting.
Yeah,
not responding.
But not responding. And so I think it's about trying to nurture, you know, those relationships with people so that it becomes more of a conversation. And then when you come to actually formulate that into a brief, even if you started off with a brief, I can guarantee you 9 times out of 10, it's not always... Sometimes briefs are like literally they've copied and pasted their entire PowerPoint into a Word document and that makes a brief. But it has to be a partnership. And that's not always easy because some people don't want to work in that way. Well, then you have to work out, do you really want to work with that kind of company or organization? I think a lot of clients get a bad rap, you know, because people moan often about briefs, particularly designers and creatives and anyone else that has an opinion. They'll be like, oh, the brief's stupid. Huh? It's not a client's job actually to know what the perfect brief is, because there isn't such a thing. There are a sequence of problems and challenges that companies have, and the brief is the articulation of what they believe at that point to be the best way to try and tackle it. So one of the things that we're doing at Human Services is approaching the people who we love, or who, you know, companies and organizations that we all really like, and offering them, you know, to give us a challenge. Like, just tell us one thing that keeps you awake at night, and we will come back to you in a finite period of time with a briefing, not a brief. A briefing, hand-delivered, ideally sat in a room, no laptops, no phones, let's have a chat. And if you like the cut of our jib, we get first refusal to make it.
Love it. Yeah.
And that's working. We're only 3 weeks old and we've already hit the ground running. But it doesn't prove anything. And by the way, that's free. You get that first thing free. Mm-hmm. So we're quite happy to commit ourselves to, you know, exploring what their problem is, because it's fun. That's the fun bit of my job. I love getting my hands dirty, but actually what I love doing is trying to articulate what different solutions could... I hate the word solution. I try to articulate what the best response might be to that particular problem or problems, because that's fun. Like working on something at the moment that's for a global motorsport franchise, and the conversation actually came from the chat that I had with you know, some of their C-suite, and it was how do we discover what our soul is. That's a good brief. Just write that on a bit of paper. You do not need anything else,
because
that's exciting.
I haven't
answered it yet.
No, but I was going to say, can we have the answer?
But it's amazing.
What's the most exciting creative thing you've ever done?
Oh, my God.
Like, the thing that you go, I'm so proud of this.
My mate Sam and I were coming back from Hackney all the way to Richmond the other day. So we had an hour to kill. He and I were talking about how many ideas that we'd probably both worked on, not together, but often, but we were talking individually, how many ideas that have just died for whatever reason. You know, they've gone into the creative heaven, sometimes for the right reasons, often for the not the good reason. And I was like, what's your like proudest piece of work? Because he's a legend in advertising. He's done some incredible work. And he sat there for a little while, and I was like, I've got my answer for you. Like, I can tell you what I think some of your best work is. And I'm gonna answer your question with the same one he gave me. And what's my favorite bit of work
you've ever done?
My next project.
Okay,
good answer.
Yeah,
that's when he gave me, and I was like, oh mate, trust you to come up with that.
Yeah.
Like, You clever bastard. There are other things I'm really proud of, but yeah. I think that's a better answer. It's because you've all, I hate everything I do the minute it gets done.
Yeah.
I can always, this is what I was saying about the curse. I can look at something I did yesterday and go, I fucking hate that. There is a better way I can do that.
Yeah.
There must be a better way I can do that.
One of the best creatives I've ever worked with was in our business for many, many years. And he may be listening to this. I won't name him out there. But I used to have to go around, like in the days when we're in the office all the time, and I'd be like, just stop.
Yeah.
It's as perfect. Like, I am so happy to send this to the client right now. But it was like, just keep moving things. I was like, just stop, because you need to be on something else now.
There's that really famous quote by, oh God, I'm terrible with names. I'm sure I've got dementia. there's that famous NFL coach, or something about the pursuit of perfection is not something. I could have got a better quote, but it's basically excellence will do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like yeah. The pursuit of perfection is futile when but excellence will do, right?
Yeah.
And I think. But I hate everything I do the minute it's done. So, you know, yes, there are things I'm proud of and milestones that I've done, but I've never got anywhere close to what I thought I might be doing. So,
yeah,
like that's... And then I think, well, Samuel L. Jackson didn't really get his big break until he was 47. I'm 49, so I'm 2 years behind. I'm not liking myself to Samuel L. Jackson, but there are plenty of people who have discovered their second and third careers in their 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Or 60s and 70s. So I've got time.
Yeah.
I've got time.
And you've done some cool stuff for sure. Like,
yeah, but it's old. And I don't know if we are ending now, but a friend of mine, Simon Gill, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago, very suddenly, he had a mantra, which I loved then. And I kind of live by now. And he was a huge figure in the creative industry. Mm. He was a beautiful human being, always very generous with his time, despite never having any. But he always said, harden the work, kind to the people. And yes. I've kind of always agreed with that, but I live by it.
Yeah.
You know, I think you can always be hard on the work, and that doesn't mean being a dick. It means, you know, always pushing your team, you know, for the very best that they can do, or asking tough questions, or being constructive, but be kind about it.
Yeah.
Just be a decent person and not a prat.
Love that. Yeah. I never met him, but I've heard lots of wonderful things about him before. Yeah, so, and that's beautiful that lives on and continues to inspire.
Yeah.
Love that. Nina, have you got any final questions? Is there anything burning?
I don't think so.
I've got a question for you, Nina.
Go on.
How long have you worked at the farm shop?
You found my LinkedIn.
Well, you looked at my profile today and I was like...
I did.
And I knew that we were linked. I was like, oh, that may be who's sitting with us today. So did a bit of due diligence.
Lovely. Yes. Good.
Done your research.
I'm just curious. Well, it's on your LinkedIn profile. I'm not stalking her. Okay.
about a year now.
How are you finding it?
Really good. I really like it.
Was that your choice, or was your parents kind of persuading you?
I wanted to get a job. Yeah. I wanted to make some money.
Also, you're working with the public, right? You're like running
exactly.
a shop.
I'm learning so many skills, customer interaction, how to talk to people.
Yeah.
Skills like on the tills, money, stuff like that.
Skills on the tills.
Skills on the tills.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's a podcast in itself.
But
I think it's super important. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of... There will be quite a lot of people that will say, oh, like, you know, kids today, they're like, they just expect everything. And I think that there's some truth to that, but I think it's often people who haven't gone out and learnt what it is to earn whatever you're getting paid, you know.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important experience because, you know, I like I said, I started off as a pot washer when I was 13 and I've never stopped working.
Yeah.
But you learn in those kind of hospitality or, you know, customer facing industries, you learn how to deal with people because some people are really arseholes.
Yeah.
And you're the front of that business. Mm-hmm. So you go like, oh, I'm sorry, your milk hasn't quite worked out or whatever it might be. Uh-huh. And I think it can only help.
Exactly.
You know,
there's
when
so many
you
skills
move forward
that you can transfer to different jobs and stuff. It's really, it's really
interesting. Do either of your parents work in marketing or creative?
No, neither of them.
Okay, good. Yeah. Do they have any idea what it means?
They do. They're very supportive and they kind of have a good idea, but I'm trying to figure it out for myself.
Have you got any ideas as to what kind of area you'd like to
I'm not sure. I just have an interest in marketing. So
yeah,
whatever. I really like kind of lifestyle, beauty, fashion, that kind of vibe. But anywhere.
Yeah, but hobby is. Your hobby. What do you do outside of school?
I am a very social person.
Okay.
And I wish I could say I had a really cool hobby, but unfortunately, I'm just. I like to. Yeah, I work a lot. I see my friends. I'm very. I'd say I'm creative. I'm studying media in school,
yeah,
and I have coursework for that. So I have to create an advertising campaign for a product. So it's super fun, and I've done a lot of that outside of school. So yeah.
I think hobby is a really weird word anyway, right?
Yeah.
Because it's so old and archaic, uh-huh. But I think it's, you know, socializing and you know, doing research for your schoolwork kind of mm-hmm. is... You know, you're not getting paid for it. It's not necessarily expected, you know, but I think also being consuming kind of popular culture
mm-hmm.
in whatever way that is, whatever way you do it, I think is kind of, you know, it's important. So you say you haven't got a hobby. I don't really either, but we are all consuming all the time
mm-hmm,
unless you
constantly are
living in a cave and, you know, you don't have a phone and you've never had the internet. You know, mm-hmm. I think... You know, just being out with your friends, like hearing, I think a lot of people get stuck on, they forget how to just go and observe the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you might hear a funny conversation over here on the train, or you see some weird interaction on the street. Like it's all going in there.
Yeah.
And I think I always try to tell clients whenever I can, regardless of your demographic or what you think your target audience is, actually the one thing you're supposed to target, the only thing you actually need to care about is the amygdala, which is an almond shape part of your brain right in the middle
mm-hmm.
next to the hippocampus. And it's where your emotional stories are kept.
Wow.
Good and bad.
Yeah.
But if you can get into the amygdala, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
But the only way you can get there is by emotion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Making people feel something.
Yeah,
whether that's a scent or a sound or a feel or a touch or a whatever it is.
Yeah.
You have to make people move.
Yeah.
And wanna move and wanna react. And that could be positive provocation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not hitting there, then what are you actually doing?
You've got no chance of it being remembered with the amount of stuff we're seeing. You've got to make them feel.
You've got about 11 seconds or less to and even less on TikTok. Jesus.
Yeah.
I am brutal with that thumb.
Gone.
If it's not a cute dog,
move on.
Well, hopefully people will be watching this back and seeing the clips on TikTok.
Yeah.
Where can people find you? Why might they like to find you? Obviously, you did your shout out to help out back in COVID times. And you've mentioned a few people that you've done mentoring with, et cetera, but you probably don't want to queue at the door.
Oh, don't mind.
Well, there you go. We heard it here.
There we go.
say that, but people don't queue up.
No.
And I'm okay with that. I'm on LinkedIn. I think my thing is / the Steve Price.
Why not?
I got really bored. I'm on various social media platforms, but fuck them. They'll find me if they really want me to.
Love it. And human service is new and happening, and we need to keep our eyes on it.
Literally,
exciting.
I haven't actually got time to, do the stuff I need to do in order to tell people. But I am quite tempted to be like off the grid a little bit.
Oh
yeah.
So we'll see.
Love it. Yeah, you don't want the robots finding you.
No, we don't.
No, amazing. But
thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for talking so openly and sharing and
it's caring.
Story.
Yeah. Sharing is caring.
Cheers, Steve. And Nina, you were incredible.
Thank you.
That was brilliant.
Really enjoyed our conversation.
It's been fantastic. Yeah. Thank you both so much. And we look forward to seeing you on another episode of Behind the Future.
That concludes another brilliant episode of Behind the Future. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen back to other episodes on YouTube or your podcast platform of choice. Make sure you hit the subscribe button, as that will help us to grow this podcast, ensuring we can get the best guests on here for you to learn from. You can also follow us on socials, linked in the show notes for exclusive content. See you on the next episode.